I can, yes.
Okay, perfect. I think this will work just great. Okay, well, Miriam, it's a pleasure to speak with you and to get to know you here. We were going to talk about blacktop passages and its focus on the road and writing and how they relate. I'm sure you feel they do. You live in a place that is all about the road. But let's begin with a question, first of all, with yourself and your poetry and writing. Where in your journey of life did the writing begin?
Really, I think, you know, like many people who continue, it started young. I think a lot of people, you know, write particularly poetry, you know, in high school or even younger. Kenneth Rexroth used to say when people asked him, when did you start writing? He would say, when did you stop writing? So I think it might be very natural, you know, in a period of introspection, childhood is ending, adolescence, for people to write, but not everybody continues. So I think for me, a kind of a crossroads came when I was in college, when I had to decide whether I was going to keep doing it and commit to it. So you could say that some of it was before that was maybe natural or just unexamined. And then when I was really about 20, I think I decided to pursue it.
Now, was that a, did you feel like it's something you had to do, basically? Was it inevitable? A kind of drive to it, or was it more of a decision you made that evolved?
You know what it's like? It was sort of like a really, really fascinating but potentially bad boyfriend. it was like, I felt like incredible compulsion, but I hadn't totally lost my wits, if that makes sense.
Yes.
It was like, you could go for this, and it would be way more exciting and maybe even dangerous than anything else you could do. But I'm the kind of person who likes to feel they're making a decision, so at least I thought I was making a decision, but who knows in retrospect.
I understand that, yes. And you began with studies. Did you study writing at all, or was it something?
No, I studied. I had some very, very classical sort of mentorship background. I studied with Robert Fitzgerald, who was a great classicist at Harvard, and the translator of the Iliad and the Odyssey, and he was my thesis advisor, and he just represented that whole world of classical thought, and he was very kind to me, even though, you know, I probably could have been more different than what he expected in a student. You know, this would have been the early 70s, and I think that the women on campus were somewhat shocking and, you know, to somebody that was on the verge of retirement, but he did a great job. What can I say? he kept his cool.
Right. And after college, did you sort of seamlessly segue into writing, or was it a path that you always took?
No, it was somewhat torturous. I went to graduate school for a year, which was a good thing. And then I stayed in graduate school to get a PhD, which was a bad thing because I couldn't get a job. I didn't know what I was doing. And I was in my mid-20s. My heart was broken. I was totally unemployed. I went completely to pieces, actually. I'd say, you know, I had a kind of a flip out of meaninglessness and existential void. And then very oddly, what happened in the midst of all of this sort of meaningless chaos is I went to Yaddo and then to McDowell. And again, I'm like 23 years old, but, you know, I'm kind of an ignoramus. Mm-hmm. And Cummington Community for the Arts. And I'm in these, you know, fancy she writers' colonies with these fancy she writers. And I sort of tried to turn myself into a writer in a serious way, particularly I was at McDowell for almost 4 months, which was really significant. And then I just fled. I split from the East Coast, I went to California. And that was kind of, I would say that was the start of, you know, like a real life.
Right. Your journey goes from the East Coast to San Francisco and ending in the Southwest. Do you find that the
exactly
the your geographic transitions, did that influence your writing, the content of your writing? The...
You know, hugely. I mean, you know, I don't know where you were raised, but it's like I was raised in New Jersey, and New Jersey is actually a very haunting, fascinating place, but it was like a prison mm-hmm. to me. You know, right across the river is Manhattan, everything anybody could ever want, but you can't get there. You're in the suburbs with a curfew, right? And I went to school in Boston, but that was still very, very much the East Coast corridor. And so it was, I'd say the West was like really, I couldn't have been more of a manifest destiny person if I'd been a 19th century president. You know what I mean? I was like, the West, it's good. It will save me. I believed, I just totally bought into it. And that was a good thing. If it turns out I was right.
Right. Absolutely. It's there's something about that open space that goes far beyond geography. I think many great men came from farms where they had nothing but sky, basically. There's something about being in openness in that nature with that is very, very affecting.
That's very nicely put.
If you were to describe your writing life as a road, what kind of road are you on? Is it a winding mountain incline, a wooded path, a freeway?
Great. I mean, what is the road? I think it's really been, you know, it's really been many different kinds of roads. It's been sort of, and sometimes it's felt like, you know, the descent into hell, you know, like a kind of the heroic quest road. But I think if I was to summarize, it's been the road into the remote. And I want to just say that I'm very easily scared. I mean, I grew up in a very urban environment, and therefore a little dirt road, you know, out in a subdivision is enough to make me think I'm out in vast wilderness. But it's been, I think it's been a road that's it's been away from civilization. And maybe back into civilization in a way. I mean, I spent several weeks out in Wendover, Utah, in an abandoned Air Force base out in this barracks on the edge of the Salt Flats. This was with Center for Land Use Interpretation, and probably that was the most psychologically remote place I had ever been, inhospitable place.
Mm-hmm.
It was very, very compelling. And so, but I tend to think that I'm further away from things than I really am. It's like, 2 hours out of Salt Lake City, I think I'm at the edges of the earth. I'm not a backpacker. How does that sound?
Right. Absolutely. I don't know if you're familiar with the works of Roald Vogg, who wrote Giants in the Earth. Who?
Oh, my God. I haven't thought about that book in a long, long time. Yes, no, I've read it.
I find fantastic. I lived on a ranch myself in New Mexico, and it was 7 miles to the mailbox and an hour to the grocery store. And
wow.
It is a little bit like being on the moon. There's a bit of
yes.
being absolutely away from everything. And it's daunting and liberating at the same time. I don't know if you feel that way.
I find that I'm on the edge of what I can do.
Right. It is on the edge of everything. Now, is that something that inspires you? Is that what you need as part of your inspiration, or does it push you?
I'm very into it. I think there's been times in my life when I've absolutely needed it, and times in my life when it's been a little more optional. But I also think there's a relationship between that kind of remoteness and intense emotional states. Which is, you know, you've had kids. It's like, when you have a small baby, you don't need to be somewhere remote because you already are somewhere remote.
Right.
It's like, you're off your map. You're into the free fall, right? Being bereaved is like that. Being grief-stricken, being in love is like that. So I think those are these very intense states that poetry, you know, thrives on. But you can't live a life where you're always confronting very intense states. So I think that physical remoteness, it works in a very similar way.
Right. I think that's fascinating. Very well put, absolutely. It's a landscape of emotions. They all are travels of sorts.
I think they really are, particularly if you like that way of approaching it.
Right. Yeah, I absolutely can relate to that. It's a wonderful thought. So, in emotions and relationships, how would you describe your relationship to writing? Are you two lovers or friends or siblings or?
I used to think it was like a, you know, classic S&M relationship where writing was the dominatrix, you know what I mean? And I was like the slave. And I used to feel, this muse does not care about me at all personally. Like, am I hungry? Am I tired? Do I want to write? Do I not want to write? Do I need to make a living? It felt like a harsh mistress, so to speak. Then I would say, you know, I probably outgrew this need for highly romantic relationships in my life. Maybe settled down a little by the time I was 30 or so. But I'd say it's very passionate. I often feel, and I don't know if other people experience this, that when I go off to be by myself to do some writing, I feel like I'm going to be with the writing. And so I'll tend to like have certain things that I want to wear or certain things that I want to eat. It's like a date.
Uh-huh.
Certain things I want to read. I mean, I want to be with the writing the same way you would be, you know, with a sweetie or a spouse or a friend. I want to keep the writing entertained. I want to look good. You know, it's just that funny. It's very personal.
Right. It is. But certainly a relationship. I suppose like all relationships.
Certainly.
Goes through stages.
Yes.
And sometimes you're not speaking to each other and sometimes everything's great. And maybe we've touched on a little bit, but I think you in your work you travel and write about traveling, and sometimes you write while traveling. What is
that's
it?
Exactly.
Does the open road inspire you?
You know, it's interesting. I've had two very intense kinds of traveling over the last 20 years. And the really on the road has been with my husband, Rich, who's like, this is his art form. When you're on a road trip with him, it's like being in the middle of somebody else's movie or play. It's so, things are so real to him before he sees them, and the options are so real that he's kind of amazing to be around. It's been super inspiring, but it's also been stressful because it's very hard to write when you're with somebody else 24 hours a day, a
mm-hmm.
person who's not a writer, you know,
yeah.
who doesn't want to stop ever. But he expanded my range physically, I mean, to the point where, you know, I mean, I just know the Southwest and the West really, really well. And, you know, parts of Florida, New England, I mean, the whole country, really. Parts of Canada, New Mexico, we've just been all over. And so he was kind of like this magic guide who appeared in my life and just started taking me anywhere that I said. I would say that I had, like, this mild interest in going someplace that I thought I could literally never get to.
Uh-huh.
And he would make it happen. I wanted to go to Casas Grandes in Chihuahua because it's the bottom of the southern part of the Anasazi culture. It was like, this was in the old days when it wasn't that hard to get into northern Mexico, but suddenly I find myself importing a car, the Toyota, like at the pharmacy, Xeroxing things, and suddenly he took me there, and I had just thought of it as impossible to get to. But it's hard to carve out the writing time on these trips, so I'm often just reduced to taking a ton of notes. And paradoxically, I think this led me to have a lot more self-assurance than I would have had. And so I've been off on my own in the national parks, in kind of remote sculpture gardens, in forests that are associated with scientific research stations,
mm-hmm.
you know, in Wendover, and that's been by myself. But Rich taught me my skill set. So then he gets sad because off I go, but it's like really he has no one but himself to blame.
Right.
But he sort of showed me how to do it. He's like the master of the road trip. How does that sound? So in a way, you know, he always says he's, you know, that he's the muse. which is for a servant of the news, because
right.
it's been very connected to what I've been doing.
Oh, that's great. You have a kind of a partner in the process, a wizard on the road with you. That's wonderful. That's really great. That also is something that pulls you along, and that's wonderful to hear. It's always good to have a partner.
Very, very lucky, yeah.
Right. On the road, it's fun to be with someone to share it with when you're driving. I mean, there's an internal road trip too, and then there's one that you share. And
yes, that's really true. My cousin is a photographer, and she and I did 6 road trips in New Mexico over the past few years. That way we called the project Road Trips to the Moon.
Uh-huh.
And that was a very different kind of experience, because she needed to take time where we were. And so that was also, I like having somebody else to collaborate with.
Right. Yes. If that's also inspiring.
Yeah, well, exactly.
Well, and there's always the inevitable, or sometimes there is, but just as perhaps an abstract question, what is your relationship to destination when traveling? Is it inevitable, necessary, the dreaded thing, the focal point?
I think it gets murkier as you get older, maybe. I mean, it's like you have to have it, right? But it might be an illusion.
Right. Absolutely. It's, you know, sometimes it's the destination is just the necessary evil at the end. But the trip itself is much more about the process than it is about the ending.
You know, I ended up writing, my last book is 7 Places in America, and it's, of course, it's about journeys. And I ended up writing this long poem that serves as a preface, which is about the women's room at the Albuquerque airport. And some artwork that's hanging there, because it was like all journeys would start and end with like having to run to the bathroom, you know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
It was like, this is my significant spot, you know, it's like this is my destination after wherever I've been, and I end up back here. And so I think there's truth in what you say.
Absolutely. Well, I find even writing is a little bit like embarking on a trip when you're about to embark on another project, and there is a destination in mind. If you know, if I have to write a screenplay, it's almost about the page count, what this road is going to be like, and I know how
uh-huh.
you know, these are all mile markers. I have to get to 120
uh-huh.
miles, and by the time I'm at 30 pages, I know how much further I have to go, and that road feels endless sometimes, and sometimes you feel like you're coasting down. So how would you describe
exactly.
the process of embarking on a new writing project, you know, in terms of, is that a road for you? Do you see that?
I've been having the experience recently of being actually very unconscious. And maybe, I mean, you're writing essentially, you know, it's a contract. And, you know, I'm teaching full time, and in a way that's drained off a lot of my organizational purposive energy.
Mm-hmm.
So that I have been finding recently, this is very unusual for me, that what I'm working on is not apparent for quite some time.
Uh-huh.
For example, I didn't know I was working on a book until I had finished it,
uh-huh.
The 7 Places. I didn't think of them as connected. I just thought of myself as having these obsessions and these gigs and just kind of writing blind, and daily life was preoccupying me and taking my sort of organizational energy. And I've recently been working on a longish piece of fiction I didn't realize it was connected to this whole other thing I had written that had some of the same characters with the same names.
Wow.
But that was just stashed, kind of. And it was only through really, like, focusing that I realized things were connected to each other. So I think it's funny. I'm almost 60, and I don't know if that's part of what's changing, but the subconscious patterns seem to really be ruling the day at the moment.
Uh-huh. Yeah. That'd be nice.
It's almost like it's almost like getting on an airplane with a toothbrush and you're like, oh, am I going to Pittsburgh? You know, it's like, I don't really know where I'm going.
Right. Pittsburgh with a toothbrush. What else do you need?
Yeah, I think there's probably better destinations, but nonetheless.
Well, what about influences for you? Are there important influences for your writing?
Totally. I mean, I'm hugely influenced, I would say, by the Beats. Phil Whalen, who was a very, very fine poet and a Zen Buddhist priest and associated with Ginsberg and the Gallery Six Reading, lived in Santa Fe in the 80s, and I was one of the people who helped take care of him, and he was just an amazing person and kind of connected me emotionally to that lineage. And the whole idea of being on the road, in the country in a certain way, not deriving from Europe, right? It's really American. You know, as a woman poet, I mean, of my age, I'm very influenced by, you know, the confessional school, by Plath, by Sexton. Maybe influence is not exactly it, because it's not like I'm trying to be like them,
right,
but feeling the weight of their influence. And then, you know, what you might call world poetry, everything from the Greek anthology, you know, to Lorca, Neruda, the Spanish poets in general, Latin American poets in general, Chinese, Japanese, just that whole international, very, very lyric poetry where people feel free to speak in a certain way that you sometimes don't see in American poetry. It's just tremendously direct and lucid, kind of beautiful surface.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's my fave. I love it wherever I find it.
Right.
And I write a lot in translation, so.
Now, what about, you know, the writer and the writing are often two different things. Is there a writer you'd like to meet, dead or alive? Or is it, you know, is the writer best kept away? Should the work stand by itself? And how does personality relate to writing?
Are we looking at the living, or are we looking at the dead?
Living or dead? Or one of each.
So one of each. Sappho, I mean, who wouldn't, right?
Right.
Being the great-great-grandmother of, you know, all women poets. And it's funny because, of course, Sappho is so associated with love and with longing. But one thing that's always given me a lot of peace of mind is that, you know, she had a school. She had a school on the island of Lesbos for singing and dancing and poetry. And so she made a living. You know, she's a headmistress. And I think, oh, Sappho had a job. And so probably, you know, it's funny. Among the dead, it probably would be William Carlos Williams. I mean, oh, he's dead too. No living. I haven't got anybody living. I just want to meet Sappho and Williams.
Okay, fine. They can all be dead.
Maybe, how about Patti Smith? Will that work for living?
Sure. Yes. And you teach writing as well. How do you approach teaching writing? You know, can one teach that? Are you simply guiding? What is your approach?
That's a great question. I worked and have worked very closely with Natalie Goldberg here, who, of course, has a very democratic concept of writing and teaching writing in terms of writing practice. And that I really, that philosophy really lines up with my sense that most people can develop a great deal creatively.
Mm-hmm.
Whether that means they're going to be professional writers or not is really up to them. But as a teacher, I see my job. I think most people are functioning, I hate to say this, but I'm going to say it anyway, are just using a tiny, tiny bit of their brain.
Mm-hmm.
And that there could be, if you can get people to go from 2% to 12%, they'll look like geniuses to themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think the teaching of writing, I mean, I teach composition. I teach all genres of creative writing. It's community college, so I'm a jack of all trades.
Mm-hmm.
I've taught technical writing. I think when you teach writing and you allow people to use this essentially completely ignored capacity,
yeah,
they're just going to flourish.
Right.
Again, does that make a professional writer? No. Should it make a professional writer? No, not at all. There are other steps after that. But I'm very lucky. I'm not teaching graduate students. You know what I mean? I'm teaching purely freshman and sophomore level and the general community.
Right.
I mean, I often have people who are like retired doctors or whatever, but I'm teaching, I like to teach beginners.
Uh-huh.
Because that's, I think, where you see the huge leap.
Right.
So,
absolutely.
I would have mixed feelings, I think, about teaching graduate students. Are you teaching graduate students or undergrads?
Both.
Both.
A class for undergrads and one for the grads. I just last night finished a class doing fundamentals of screenwriting with non-writers. And that's the closest I get to what you're talking about. These are editors and producers and cinematographers. And just like you said, the leap from where they start and end up is so tremendous and really actually moving, because they find voices in themselves they had no idea they had.
Exactly.
Abilities that just, you know, even just, It's a process I'm so honored to be a part of it and to see them thrive in that way. And we read the last script last night, and it was just blew me away what everybody
uh-huh.
came out with. And these are
uh-huh.
kids that thought, I don't even know how to write, you know, I have no idea how to do that. And I all of them discovered something inside themselves, just like you're saying. It's there, and most people just don't use it.
Exactly. I mean, and then, you know, in some strange way, I don't know what your experience has been, but, you know, talent is a highly overrated thing. I've seen a few people, you know, have crossed my path who I would say were extraordinarily talented, but they did not necessarily develop as writers.
Right.
It's like talent is a gift, but it's the development of talent is something, it takes a certain kind of personality type, and it's hard to teach that.
Yes.
So, okay, that's interesting. And it's interesting what you were saying. Yeah.
Yeah, I've really found that I really love that process of watching that. It's like a miracle, watching this unfold.
It really is.
And I'm sure you do as well. It's almost invisible what you do when you tease that out of people, because it's all about encouraging and getting out of the way at the same time,
uh-huh.
and guiding in this way that is probably unseen. It's difficult to, you know, it's a funny process. It's invisible and really powerful at the same time. And when you see
it's a midwifery of a kind.
Yeah, exactly. It's absolutely birthing something. It's all about creation, ultimately. So it's a beautiful thing to watch. Well, then, maybe talking about New Mexico specifically, and, you know, the landscape of New Mexico is such of extraordinary beauty and also harshness and emptiness and power. And how does the landscape, or would you say the landscape of New Mexico specifically, influences your writing?
Well, you put it very nicely. I mean, when I first came here, I was obsessed with it. I mean, I couldn't get enough of it. I didn't really understand what I was looking at. I didn't know the names of plants. I didn't know the names of mountains. I didn't know what people's behavior meant. I was on this, you know, tremendous learning curve
mm-hmm.
to try to understand it. And in some funny way, although I think this is not really a fashionable thing to say, the city of Santa Fe itself, with all of its conflict and contrast, has been really important to me. I mean, I've been on the west side of Santa Fe, you know, since like 1986, and my daughter was born here, went through the public schools here, and it's just this funky neighborhood, and I had this experience where I turn into my driveway, and I look at my little funky house, and I thought, was all my struggle and journeying and trying to escape, was it all just for this? You know, it's like the west side of Santa Fe. And I thought, you know, it really was. And there's a poem by Borges that says something like, this kind of decrepit, you know, sort of mediocre neighborhood is made beautiful by your love for it. And I thought, you know, that's really the shabbiness of poverty and, you know, sort of being a place that the world has forgotten,
mm-hmm.
that you see in parts of New Mexico. It's also, I think, it's made beautiful by your love for it.
Yeah.
So it's been very powerful. But I'll always be an outsider. That's the one thing. And maybe that's not bad for a writer.
That's probably necessary. I feel that, yes. I personally need the distance. I get very deep into people, and I have to keep my distance at the same time. Or it's hard to
uh-huh.
see.
It's, yes.
You can't judge, and you can't get too involved. Those are the two things I find. Yeah, it's the vision. I was going to ask you, you know, I mean, writing is vision, ultimately. Do you think, is your writing an inner vision, an outer? Does it, you know, come from the outside as influence? Does it come from the inside? Is it both? You know, where's the vision for you? Just where your vision, you know, sparks, inside, outside, or both?
You know, it would be great to know the real answer. I don't know if there is a real answer. I experience it as coming from the outside.
Mm-hmm.
I know it must be coming from the inside on some level, right? Because that's how sort of the human mind is structured, but I always experience it as external. I heard a Zen teacher, Joan Sutherland Roshi, she once said that anybody who has an enlightenment experience, that the trigger comes from outside, that, you know, the Buddha became enlightened when he saw the morning star rise.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, that's just like poetry. For me, in any case, it's always coming from the outside. But maybe you have to have some kind of quality of availability, right, or openness,
yeah.
Or it's maybe it really is relational, but I don't feel like something is coming up deep within me. I'm sure writers feel this way. I always feel like something has caught my interest. You know, something is singing outside, and that's what's happening.
Right.
This is such a great question. It would be great to ask, like, 50 people the same question.
Right, and probably get many different answers, absolutely. Maybe it's an alchemy of both, you know, the combination, the outer cue and the inner response that creates...
Exactly.
...the translation into vision.
Exactly.
Well, poetry, now, that's your main love and focus and work. You've written other forms. What's your favorite form of poetry? Perhaps in your own writing and perhaps what you appreciate without writing it.
I like very short forms. I'm no master of them. I mean, I love traditional haiku, and I like the short lyric poem, you know,
mm-hmm.
I just like that sexiness, that seductive quality where it just sort of says, you know, come with me, and it doesn't take up the whole page. How does that sound? That's my fave.
Yes. Absolutely. And it's like, short form poetry and haikus are, I mean, they're like, it's like food almost for me. I find poetry is literally just something so delicate. It's the highest form of some kind of culinary experience. Words have these flavors that are just delicious, and, you know, the less, the more important every flavor is, so the less words. So I think that's beautiful. I agree. What about the road trips? What's the most unforgettable road trip you ever took?
Ooh.
Your most favorite. Or unforgettable.
Unforgettable. There are a lot of them, but I think driving from Phoenix to La Jolla, because it was like the last piece of the Western trip. You know what I mean? Almost step by step. We flew to Phoenix. It was one of these you know, on Southwest, it was like $42 to fly to Phoenix instead of putting the miles on the car,
right.
You know. Went to Phoenix and got a rental car, and obviously went out through the desert, you know, through the Mojave, parts of the Mojave, and little hot springs, but it really felt like the grapes of wrath or something, you know, like, finally, it's California, there's like 900 Thai restaurants in one block. it was just at the beach. It was just, you know, it was that arrival in paradise, I think, really made it unforgettable.
Right. That's wonderful. There's intangible things that make these things unforgettable. They are experiential. They have to be described through something poetic. It's hard to you couldn't even film it, I think, adequately to kind of bring that across.
No, it's true because sometimes also there's this thing about, like, you go to the Grand Canyon and you take the kids to the Grand Canyon, and all the kids remember about the Grand Canyon is some squirrels, right? And it's like, was that a good experience or a bad experience? I mean, was it worth going to the Grand Canyon to see the squirrel? Like, I found this very haunting when my daughter was little. We would take her and friends, and we would go to Canyon to Shea, we would go here and there, and it seemed like they never knew where they were.
Mm-hmm.
It was always about, like, cheese doodles in the back seat or some funny motel that they thought was scary. And yet, are they getting something that's not about being home? Right? But it goes back to your question of destination. It's like, what makes something memorable? It really might be the squirrels, but you might not be able to see those squirrels unless you went all the way to the Grand Canyon.
Right.
So it's a little perplexing, but it might be worth it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think all of those experiences. I think that's very, very observant. And thinking back to my kids, absolutely. It is the squirrel. It's that rock they found. We went to Europe and during the fall, and living in California, and at that time, my kids really hadn't developed a great relationship with leaves, and. We were there in October, and all of Germany is, you know, covered in golden, yellow, red leaves everywhere. And my daughter ran everywhere into the street. All of my pockets were stuffed with leaves because it's like she had to save every one of them. Every one of these beautiful things had to be rescued somehow from the streets, from the sidewalk. And that's what I remember. I do. I remember her, and I remember the leaves, and it's those moments, I guess.
It's very lovely.
But you're right. It is a kind of you're in a state of freedom when you're outside of your usual, the progress of every day where you have your routines, and when you're outside of that routine, I think that's when you see the squirrels and the leaves a little bit differently. At least it's natural. I think you have to work harder to see those things when you're traveling through your routine.
Absolutely.
Then what about writing? You've also written novelistically in prose, and how do they differ for you as an experience on a writing level? Do you enjoy one? I mean, the other, is it, do you enjoy going back and forth sometimes? How do you feel about writing other than poetry?
I like going back and forth. It's given me respect for friends of mine who are novelists. I mean, there's a lot more heavy lifting in any form other than poetry. You know, poets will carry on about how hard it is, but it's not that time-consuming. I mean, unless you're doing something I'm not doing, you know what I mean, which is worrying about every word. So I think that prose, it's not as... it's got more elbow grease in it, and that's, first of all, that's a great thing because it just lets you experiment and work. And also, I think it's slightly less inspiration dependent, which is to say, to me, like a B-plus essay, a pretty good essay would be worth writing, but a pretty good poem I would tend to have to throw out. The poetry is much more like, did you hit the high note?
Uh-huh.
Is it really quite functional? But I feel that effort is more appreciated by prose, if that makes sense. And poetry is a little more inspiration dependent for me.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot more rolling up your sleeves involved.
Exactly.
And
but that's a nice thing. It lets you get through the afternoon and learn something.
Yeah. The page count. You can literally count the progress, again, just like the miles. Now, if you will probably wrap up pretty soon, if you could get in your car right now and just drive anywhere in America today, where would you drive, if nothing else matters?
Well, I'm leaving tomorrow, so shall I just tell you where I'm going?
Sure.
I think Reno to Great Basin.
Mhm.
And then maybe back through Llano Lake. To go, you know, the loneliest highway, which is Route 50?
Right.
Is it's still pretty lonely, but I think someplace really big, really mountainous, dry. It really has no destination.
Right.
And it's got hot springs and some archaeology and some rock art and some little weird funky towns. But almost it's almost just pure road, right? Because, you know, if you end up in Ely, Nevada, you know, not to badmouth Ely, Nevada, but is that exactly a destination?
Right.
You know, you're more like passing through it. I think a trip that is just passing through.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So the experience is travel. Again, is it traveling or is it destination?
Exactly.
I love that notion of going somewhere where there is no destination.
Yeah, exactly. And, I don't mind going someplace where there's, great Asian food, but that might not be a road trip.
Right.
And I always have fear of, what am I going to eat? You know, like a cheese sandwich, but, you know, in these environments, but what the heck, it's worth it.
That's true. The quandary of what do I eat on the road trip is a big one. Oh, well, and to that end, I was going to ask you, since you're in New Mexico, for you, is it red or green chili? I have to just ask.
It's totally so green. What about you?
Christmas. I always go Christmas.
Christmas, very good. I have to say, it ruined me. It was just definitely like a drug. It's like, once I ate it,
yeah,
I just wanted to keep eating it the rest of my life, and I'd come very unhappy if I couldn't. So.
Yes, I know. When I come to New Mexico, a big part of my thinking all day is just about, okay, where am I eating next, and which chili is it going to be? I think I just need the dialectic of the red and the green together.
You have to say that's one great thing about New Mexico, is that any place remote has chili.
Right. Yes. Exactly.
It's not American food. It's not American road food, the most disgusting ham sandwich in the world.
No.
It's gonna be, something that's got chili on it.
Yep, you can go into the smallest little hole in the wall and you're gonna get chili. It's
exactly.
Awesome. That's almost like nowhere else. It is like nowhere else in America. It's very unique and really special about New Mexico. Then final question. For your life, do you see a final destination? Is there something you're headed towards, or is it the open road, the no destination?
You know what? I'm trying to find out the answer to that question. I feel like that, I don't have the answer. I feel like that is the question of the moment. How does that sound?
Yeah, that sounds very valid, I think. I think it's probably an ongoing evolution, that question.
I think it is. And it's kind of up for me right now, because that feeling of age and time and its limitations, its constrictions, which might not be bad, but trying to figure it out, but haven't figured it out.
Well, that's perfectly fine. When you do, let me know. I'm trying to figure it out myself. Life is, I find, you know, having written stories and everything is about story, which is, again, slightly different than poetry, of course.
Mm-hmm.
What's the story? I'm always looking for the story. How does the story end? But
and how would you know the one way about yourself? Right, that's a tricky one.
It's hardest about yourself. I can tell everybody else's story. I can tell them their story, but your own is hard to see. I don't know why. It's that distance that
it
you
is.
Need.
Mhm. I think maybe it's a necessity in some way too.
Right.
It's been nice to talk to you.
Yes, very wonderful to talk to you. I'm glad we had this opportunity, and hopefully we'll meet
Thank
again.
You.
And we'll do it again sometime.
Call me if you come to Santa Fe.
Okay, definitely. This happens. Okay. This happens pretty regularly. I'd
and
love to meet.
Drop me a note when this, you know, when this becomes part of something.
Okay.
Or goes up or whatever, so that I can look for it.
Absolutely.
And thanks for taking the time. This was very enjoyable.
Thank you. Yes, for me too. All right, great,
All
Miriam.
Right, good.
Thank
Have
you.
Have a nice rest of the day.
You too.
Yeah. Bye.
Bye.